All right, welcome back to this week's episode of MVP Podcast, Season 3, Episode 29. We have Amanda George here from the great Northeast in the Boston area. Thanks for giving us the time.
Yeah, my pleasure. I'm excited to be here.
I'm excited to learn about some Boston culture because we do not have anybody yet from Boston. We've had...
Yes, we did. We had one.
We had one from Boston. Oh, you're old...
My boss.
Yeah, that's right. That is right. We're not going to count her. So we only have one person from Boston. No, it's super cool. I'm excited to learn more about it because the outlay of Boston and the outlay of Milwaukee, way different, which is where we're coming from. So it's kind of a culture clash there.
Yeah, Boston's very unique. We're not as mean as everyone thinks we are. We're just busy. We like to get it done.
That was the first thing I had to learn dealing with the Northeast. That's for sure. And Amanda, what is it that you do in the Northeast? Can you give our listeners like a 20-second intro of like, this is what I do in the Northeast. And then we're going to get into how you got there.
Okay, cool. Yeah, no, I work for Century 21. I'm a real estate agent. My husband and I work together as a team. He's newly licensed. I've been doing this for about 12 years now, but I work with investors, builders, developers, first-time buyers, downsizers, you name it. We do not discriminate. We have a lot of expertise in getting all different kinds of people into the house that they want.
Nice. So you are now training the protege to come up and take over.
That's right.
And then you retire and then he does all the work.
He's heading up the multimedia department stuff for us. So we're started a podcast too. Right now we're just on YouTube, but we're getting there with all the extras.
That's cool. So is he on the podcast with you and you shoot yours?
Yeah, so we do the podcast together. It's called Married to Real Estate. And so it's just like him and I talking about life, kids, being married, working together. We've had a couple interviews so far. So, I mean, it's super casual, just kind of like shooting the shit.
Yeah, that's kind of what we like. When we started this podcast, we had a whole list of questions we're going to ask and get answered. And it like got so clunky and we'd missed the flow of the show. So we just went to like, all right, we're just going to have a conversation, see where it takes us. Cause everybody's different and you can't just have 10 questions that fit for everybody.
Right. Exactly.
Cause we've had interior designers, we've had feng shui experts, we've had investors, we've had real estate agents,
plumbers.
Yep. So it was so diverse that we just kind of scrapped it. We're like, all right, we're just going to take it and see where it goes.
Yeah. I think that's the best way to do it. I mean, it's all, you know, you have to provide entertaining content, but at the same time, we try to be educational and give people the real life stories and not like this, especially in Boston, it's such a unique market. When you look at national statistics for what the housing market is doing, Boston's such an anomaly and so much of that stuff really just doesn't apply.
Yeah. And you were talking a little bit before we started recording about that. And we're going to get into that probably right after we find out how did you get into real estate? What was you can take this personal, you can take it business, just whatever road led you, whatever cobblestone road led you to real estate.
Yeah. It was just kind of on a whim. My husband and I had just moved in together and I was from the north, we call it the North Shore. So like 15 miles north of Boston, he's about 15 miles south of Boston. And I moved down to the South Shore and I'm like, this is temporary. Like people don't cross the bridge. Like if you're from the North Shore, you don't move to the South Shore. And so I was really heavily invested in like searching for something, somewhere else to live. And he was like, you're obsessed with real estate. Why don't you get your real estate license? And I was like, well, what do you mean? I went to college for like exercise physiology. Like, I don't know. And he's like, it's a class, just go take the class. And so I did. And I just, you know, it's an intimidating class. I don't know how it is where you guys are, but a lot of people really try to discourage you. Oh, it's so hard. The test is crazy. Like you have to take it 5 times. And so I just studied my butt off and I said, I don't pass this test on the first go. I'm not meant to be a real estate agent and I'm going to figure something else out. And I did, and I did it part-time for a while. I actually worked in the cosmetology industry. And so I was doing it part-time because I had a flexible schedule, which was great. But I, in order to really make it as a realtor, you need to be full-time. You can do your best to be there for all of your clients, but it's kind of one of those jobs. It's scary to get into full-time because it's commission only. There are no benefits. Mm-hmm. But if you don't make the time to devote to it, you can't grow. And so I just kind of, once I did that, my career really took off. So we've just been riding the wave together now for the last couple of years.
That's awesome. And in the beginning, when you were doing it part-time, do you remember like how many clients you were taking on, deal size? Like you don't, I don't need like exact numbers, but what was the difference between going at this as a hobby mm-hmm. and going at this as a career?
So my first year, I think I had one or two clients, friends of mine, the way every, you know, contact your sphere, you know, go that route.
Your first 100 people.
Yes. So that was my first couple of years, very slow. And actually I ended up, you know, I was after that, I would say you've got to be in the business 3 or 4 years before you get a little bit of momentum. And so once I started making, you know, I was probably taking home after saving for taxes and everything like $40,000-ish a year, maybe years like 3 and 4. And then I kind of fell into a paralegal position, kind of like figuring out, is real estate really going to work for me? You know, how can I make some real money? Like this money is okay, but if I'm going to do, you know, if I'm going to quit my other job, I need to be making more. And I kind of fell into a paralegal role with an attorney that I had worked with before on a few deals. And I did that for a couple of years, actually, while doing real estate. He was awesome. He gave me so much flexibility. So I was able to begin pursuing real estate full time while also working for him full time. And then at that point, you know, I was doing probably between like $4 million and $6 million in sales a year. And then I just, once I finally got the confidence to go full time, I went 10, 15, 20 million instantaneously, pretty much. I mean, it was also networking. Getting in with some really great developers, investors, people who, surrounding yourself with people who are growing and want you to grow and want to help you grow.
Yeah. And some of that comes with being able to do it full time.
Yeah.
Some is just because of the duration, you get referrals, your name gets out there, you get more experience, you get more confident. For you, what would you say was the biggest, the highest percentage? Was it because you've been doing it for 4 years? Is it because you made the jump to go full time and made yourself accessible to it?
I think it was really making the jump to go full time. If you have other things to do that are making you money, that are guaranteed money, you're going to prioritize that, right? Mm-hmm. So when you're hungry for it and you know, not that you need the paycheck, but you know, what's going to help you create your business, it's the clients. And so when you make the free time to devote it to working on your business and yourself, rather than chasing your hourly paycheck, people can feel that you're passionate about it, and they can feel a better sense of security in knowing that you're experienced and that you know what you're doing and that they're in good hands working with you, and that you're not, you know, canceling appointments and rescheduling things because you have other priorities.
Yeah. Right. Yeah. That was always the tough part. And you see that with part-time agents, because they are everywhere. And it's an industry that there are, I mean, it's allowed, and it, mm-hmm. I don't know, it kind of lines up well with people that want to do it full time, because it's usually nights and weekends. So you're going to see it all over the place. Mm-hmm. But those during the day periods where you can network and meet people and take those one-off meetings will go a lot farther than people think.
Exactly. It's always like the, you know, like you said, the one-off meetings that could change everything for you. And I mean, I think it's scary to have to go into it full time. If you don't have any money saved or you don't have the luxury of not needing a paycheck, right? It's very scary to get into it full time. I always recommend to new agents to join a team if they can. It's something that I did not do that I think would have helped me go full time a lot sooner had I done it. You know, I'm lucky to have an amazing, he's a fantastic mentor. He's so smart. But if you're motivated, it is not the career for you. And I think a lot of people get into it thinking they're going to have, you know, all this free time and it's going to be easy money. And I mean, I don't work 9 to 5, but I work 24/7. And yeah. So, you know, it's, yeah, I can take Monday off if I want to go grab a lunch and it's, I don't have to be back in the office, but then I'm working Monday evening when my kids are in bed, you know, at 10, yep. 11 o'clock. So.
Yep. That is so true. And you talked a little bit about like the whole, you moved to the South Side, you're trying to move out. You were making X amount of dollars. You were talking a little bit about Boston's market and the price point of everything in that Boston proper. Like I can see why you were chomping at the bit to make more money because prices out there are escalating quickly.
Yeah.
Can you go into like what you're seeing in that Boston market? Because when you were talking a little bit before we started recording, it was crazy to hear the prices. We just had a person from Hawaii last week and he was talking about his prices. And I mean, he bought a house for almost 8 that was like pretty much a knockdown. Mm-hmm. And I'm like, man, it was a hard pill to swallow when I bought something for like 350 as a knockdown. Mm-hmm. And like I think you're more on like the Hawaii prices. So go into what you're seeing in like the Boston proper and the markets that you specifically kind of work in.
Yeah, it's expensive. It is, if you're an investor and you're looking at multifamily properties, the numbers barely work. You are looking at $1 million for a 3-family. We call them triple deckers. I don't know what you guys have out there, but
the triplex is what we call it here.
Yeah. So if you're looking at something like that, they barely cash flow because especially if you can't get away with putting down, you know, getting an FHA loan. And most of these properties are not in a condition where an FHA loan is.
Because they're all older buildings, I'm imagining.
Yes. They're built in 1900, 1920. You know, they've got termites, they have fieldstone foundations that are cracking. They need a lot of work and you're still.
And for a loan package that will call you out for like paint chipping, mm-hmm. like a lot of those issues,
Oh, the paint is chipped.
Yeah.
And, it's, you know, maybe for something that's in really rough shape in Boston proper, you can get a little under $1 million, you know, 600,000, 700,000, 800,000, but if you're looking at, I mean, something that's livable, just outdated, you're still spending $1 million easy.
And what are rents for those units?
I mean, it depends on the bedroom count really, but yeah. I had a triple decker in Dorchester, an up and coming neighborhood, Savin Hill part of Dorchester. It's a good alternative to South Boston, which is very expensive. You're spending, you know, minimum probably $3,000 for a 2-bedroom. So we do have a lot of overflow coming into Dorchester. The Savin Hill neighborhood, I had a 3-bedroom for $2,500 that, I mean, it was from 1970. I mean, it was nothing special. I mean, the cabinets were painted, hardwood floors, you know, you have that kind of old school charm, but we were charging $2,500 because of the condition and it's a 3-bedroom unit. So if you want something updated, you're spending upwards of $3,000.
Wow. That's crazy. We just started managing a house. Somebody moved out to a different state here and we're managing the property. We just updated it and it's an updated full house. And that is, he's pushing the high side of 2000.
Wow.
And that's for a basement and a 3-bedroom, 2.5 mm-hmm. bath.
Yeah. I mean, you can, the further you get from the city, obviously the more affordable it becomes. But even in, you know, say I live in Randolph, which is like 17 miles from the airport. So a little bit south of the city, or a few towns out from, so there's like two towns in between me and Dorchester, which is like where Boston kind of starts. And if you're looking in the next town over, Quincy, you know, one town closer to the city, you're still paying $1,900 for a crummy one bedroom.
Wow. That is crazy.
You know, maybe crazy a two pricing. Bedroom, but nothing big. I mean, you're not getting 1,100 square feet. You're getting like 800, maybe 950.
That's bigger than my house. I mean,
that's insane for a rental price. But I mean, when you don't,
you know, then you got to spend $1 million to get the building, and you know, you're making $100 a month if you're lucky. And that's the other problem, right? Is people are selling these multifamilies as if they're already, you know, 4, 5, 6, 7 cap, right? And then it's like, no, you have to buy it for $1 million. Now you need to get all these tenants out and raise the rents in order to make the numbers work. And that's a lot of work for an investor. Yeah. You know, some people just don't have that time.
Yeah. Do you work specifically, I mean, not only with, but primarily with investors?
I don't. I work, I mean, yeah, really 50-50. I have a lot of first-time buyers. I try to get on that path so that they can be, so that they can put themselves in a position where they can use their equity to get into another home or a bigger home. And I really try to redirect them away from thinking that they're going to get everything that they want and get their dream home on the first go, because it's such an expensive market. And it's a really good opportunity to get into a position to become an investor yourself, right? Even if you don't want to buy and hold property for the long term, if you can do it in the short term and gain a little bit of equity and, you know, or fix the property up, that's the other thing, right? Everyone wants their pretty house on the first try. Get in, do the work, cash out, refi, you know, use that money to get into the next project or the next home instead of saving while you're paying somebody else's mortgage. And now with inflation, the rise in interest rates, right? That's what everyone's feeling right now. So I kind of turn some people into investors where they otherwise wouldn't have been. But I'm lucky enough to, in Boston, we have such a diverse market where, you know, we have opportunity for investors. It's very slim pickings for first time home buyers. Yeah. And so it's kind of a good way to transition into home ownership and hopefully wealth. If you can use your first time home buyer status to get yourself into a better position to repeat the cycle.
Yeah, I can definitely see Boston being a very tough first-time home buyer market.
Yeah,
with prices being so high,
it's very expensive, and a lot of people try and save, and then rents keep increasing. I mean, I don't know who can save any money when you're paying $3,000 a month for rent. And so, if you can just save that 3.5%. And right now we are seeing a little bit of more negotiating power with buyers, right? We're not having like a huge downturn in pricing, but buyers can ask for closing cost credits right now. Buyers can get repairs done after their home inspections. I mean, you couldn't even get an offer accepted with a home inspection contingency 6 months ago. So things are going back to normal, which is nice. It's a nice relief for a lot of buyers who took a break from the market. And now we've had a little dip in interest rates, and so you've got a few people kind of jumping back in.
Yeah, no, definitely. It was same kind of thing over here where you put in an offer, I mean, sometimes 20, 30 over, and you had one buyer I was working with had, they had to get financed, and they were losing because everything else was cash. And the price point that they were working in, which was below 300, like you're just going to see a lot of cash buyers, and it's going to be tough to compete with a cash offer with no contingencies, clean offer as you can make it. And they've got, all they need is an appraisal contingency because they need to.
Yeah.
And they lose out. And in one, they had actually offered more money and they took the lower money because it was cash. So yeah. it was just a tough position for them. Now I'm trying to put themselves in Boston, where I'm sure the buyer pool is higher and the inventory is lower and yeah. prices are double. So a super hard position. So kudos to you for kind of taking your market, not as a deficit, but as an opportunity for them to be, hey, you might not be able to get what you want right now, but if you do these steps, you can get into the house you want. And you're also going to keep, I would think, those clients as repeat customers when they go to sell and buy again.
Oh yeah. I have a pretty big list of repeat clients. I mean, I've sold the same house 2 and 3 times.
That's gotta be a very unique like aspect of like, oh, the first time I went through this deal,
right.
this is what it happened. Is,
and it's nice to see the changes that people make too. And I had one house that I just sold recently, maybe in the fall. And they've been there, they were planning on it being their forever home. So they were doing some work over time. It had been maybe 5 years or so. And they got relocated for work. And so they were hurrying to finish all their projects so that we could get it on the market. And it was like amazing, the transformation. I mean, they doubled their
That's awesome.
Doubled what they paid for the house almost.
In 5 years, that's awesome.
Yeah.
Did they sell in like the height of COVID and all
yeah,
that?
Yeah, they did. So they
that helped.
Already relocated. And in the fall, it was still a pretty hot market. But even then, we were starting to see, I think I had 2 offers and, you know, like a little bit below asking and a little bit above asking. And I think that is one of like the biggest misconceptions about a multiple offer market, right? You have, okay, you got 6 offers on the house, but what no one tells you is that 2 of them were under asking. One of them had a home sale contingency. One of them was at asking, you know, one was a little bit over. And then you have that one offer that like is 50, 60, 100,000 over asking that blows everyone out of the water. And that kind of, it messes with the comps because you can't, and right now when we're in this shifting market and you have to really educate your seller, like, look, I know we like to go back 6 months, but like I'm going back 2 months if we can, because right. we need to see what's changed and we need to look at the list price versus the sales price. I'm not comping these houses based on that one house that sold for $100,000 over asking, because mm-hmm. guess what? That buyer is out of the market.
Yeah.
You're left with those 5 buyers that didn't get that house. And yep. this is what they're paying. You know, they're looking at the list price. That's their wheelhouse. And so you really have to educate the sellers right now, because that's why you're seeing the price drops. It's not because the market's crashing. It's because sellers have not been properly educated on what has changed in the market 6 months ago versus today, and how you need to price your home in order to either sell it at list price or get the multiple offers. If you want multiple offers, you always need to price below market.
Yeah.
And so that's why we're seeing price drops, because sellers didn't want to listen. Agents didn't put their foot down, and now they're chasing the market down, and you're going to see those same houses sit, and you're going to see them continue to price drop because they didn't listen the first time around.
Yeah. And did you, what was that, Natasha?
Working with the kids, like just listen.
Yes, exactly. Right. That's where being a mom comes in handy. Right. These are the rules, take it or leave it.
Exactly. Or no cookies for dessert.
You talked about like, as an agent, like putting your foot down, or on the listing side, like educating. For new agents, that is a very, very hard thing to do, because there's a little bit of you that's like, well, it's their house. And like, I mean, ultimately they do get the decision. They get to make the decision. Right. All we get to do is put the facts in front and suggest what we think. They get the last decision. But I know when I was an agent, it was tough to like, I'd always think I'm bringing them bad news, because like everybody wants to sell it for more and they want to buy it for less, and they want the thing that they did to their house to boost their resale value. But sometimes you have to be like, it was a cool feature, but it doesn't add anything to it. Yeah. It's just cool. That's all it is. Mm-hmm. And there's the emotional tie to it. So it's super hard as an agent to step in and be like, hey, you hired me and I'm going to give you some bad news off the start.
Right.
Do you know when something like turned in your head where you're just like, I'm done playing the game. I'm just going to give them what I think. And I'm going to stand firm with what I think and what I see.
You know, I think it's one of those things where every situation, and that's the great thing about real estate, right? Every transaction is different. Every situation you're in is new. So there are times where I might say to someone, okay, look, we'll do it your way. But if it doesn't work and this we're doing, and I let them know that doing it that way is the kiss of death. Because days on market is killer. And so if we waste even 7 days on the market doing it your way, we've lost 7 days on the market. And there, that's your opportunity to get the most money for your home. Yep. And I think probably after living that a few times as a new agent and you say, look, I was right. You know, why didn't I just try to educate them better? You will eventually, when you get, I think you have to kind of get to the point where you don't take every client. And that is not easy to do as a new agent.
Bells, like ding, 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 ding on that one. Don't take every client.
You can't. And when you're new, you do, because you want to learn. You need to do it in order to know what you're doing and gain the confidence. And so in some instances, I guess that is a good thing. Like, it's trial and error, right? You work with every client and then you figure out what kind of agent you are and what kind of clients you want to work with. And then that can kind of like guide you for the rest of your career. And I mean, I don't work with every client that I meet. And it's because I'm going to tell you what's realistic. And if you have expectations that I can't meet, then maybe you should work with somebody who thinks that they can meet them, because I don't want to do you a disservice. If you think that that's really out there, then, that's great, but I can't deliver it. And so I don't think that that's like a detriment to you as an agent, knowing that. Because in reality, nobody can probably deliver it. So don't feel like it's you personally that can't make it happen.
Yeah.
Once you work with a few unrealistic people, I think that it finally starts to register.
Yeah. Okay. No, definitely. It took me a couple of years to do that as well. Because when I started, it was like, I'm gonna work with everybody and we're going to, and obviously me being stubborn, I was going to make it work. It was going to be fine. And then I would go to like listing meetings or buyer meetings. And at the end of it, it was like, I just don't think this is going to be a good fit, but I can give you a referral to somebody and I'd pass them along. Cause either we just didn't see the world the same, or they were asking for something that I think they're just way off base. And in our meeting, I was trying to like slowly suggest other options that maybe I didn't feel like they were on board with, or they were going to fight me on certain things that I felt were going to be very important. And that's where it was like, let's just call it quits. Like, we don't need to work together. If you ultimately don't want to work with me and I don't want to work with you, like, there's no reason to force it. You're going to find an agent that will work with you and you'll like the process, because this is a big deal and you should enjoy the process, whether it's a rocky one or an easy one. At least enjoy it.
It's like dating too, you know?
It is.
Or you know pretty quickly when the red flags go up. You just have to learn, how to get out.
I know.
Elegantly excuse yourself.
Yeah, exactly.
And then you pull out the it's not you, it's me line if it doesn't work. How much of your, because you said you work for a bigger box broker. Who was it? It was. So
I work for Century 21.
That's what I thought it was. I didn't want to misspeak.
Yeah, no, it's each office is franchised. So they're all independently owned. So you get the brand recognition of, you know, a worldwide company, but we have two offices in my firm. We have an office in Brighton, which is just, is considered part of Boston. And then we have an office in Weston, which is a suburb just outside the city. So, we run more like a boutique firm. My boss is, it's him, his wife, his son works there. So they've got a whole family affair going on. And now my husband and I. And so it's great because everyone is, there's always someone that you can go to. It is not, you know, what you think of corporate. You have to call through and all that sort of thing. It's, you know, he's there when I need him. He can step in. He's always there to answer questions. And so that's what, you know, I really like about working there. It's him. He's an amazing broker and he's been doing it a long time.
That's awesome.
That kind of answered my question. I was going to talk to you about when you got you passed your test the first time. Congratulations, by the way.
Thank you.
Now you're sitting with this long thing of, okay, I'm licensed, but I need to hang my license somewhere so I can actually do this. Did you go through like different brokers or did you get referred to Century 21 and then you like fell in love there? Sounds like you got the best of both worlds. You've got the brand recognition, but it works as a boutique. And I'm an agent for a boutique as well. Mm-hmm. Cause I like that smaller feel. So yeah. Like, as you got your test and you're looking at brokers, like what was your thought process on how you selected your broker?
Well, I did go, I did meet with a few people. Most of them were referrals from other agents that I had known, you know, over the years, but no one that I was very close with that was an agent already and could, you know, kind of drag me over to where they were. So it was nice in that sense that I could really make the decision for myself. So I did interview mostly with bigger firms, for the reason of the brand recognition. So if you join a boutique firm and you can focus in one neighborhood that you're already familiar with or experienced with or live in, that might work for some people. But as a newer agent, I wanted to make sure that I had a little bit more, I was able to cover more ground with the brand I was associated with. And I actually had a client. My boss's wife was a client of mine when I was in the cosmetology industry. And she was like, we had just got to talking and I told her I was about to take the test. And she said, well, make sure you talk to my husband. You know, we're in real estate. She was a newer client at the time. So I didn't know all the details of her work. And he was very willing to give me the flexibility that I needed to be a part-time agent. You know, I didn't have to do desk time. I didn't have to be on the rentals team. I didn't have to go to these meetings. And so it, to me, was running more boutique. And so it just turned out to be a great fit for my life at the time. And the office was in a location that was convenient to my other job. And so I was able to go back and forth if I needed to.
Nice.
And so those are really the driving factors for me. They do have some great technology that they, you know, could utilize. I think everyone could, it's always changing, right? So every brokerage can always utilize technology better, but
yeah,
it's really what you can make the most of yourself. And, you know, like we said before, if you're a self-starter, you can manage on your own.
Yeah. Did you interview with any brokerages that you just didn't align with? And were there like certain things that you're like,
Yeah, I don't want to name names, but
no, you don't have to name names because I interviewed with some bigger box when I started because the first thing I went to is like, okay, I want to get a brand that people know because then like getting referrals or getting clients would be easier because I can say I'm backed up by this huge brand and it was super good. I did not like the desk fees and the admin fees and it was like $600 a month and like it didn't seem like it was. I'm going to get to know you. You're another person in the office and the commission structures and the time that they needed in the office compared to like compensation there were just some things that I just didn't like, which is why I went boutique because of the freedom and the flexibility and their percentages were better. So yeah, don't name names.
Yeah.
We can do that. But what were some of the things that you were like, Or people that are thinking about getting into being an agent of real estate, like, hey, when you interview these brokers, like, ask about these things because they're big.
They are. I think, you know, everyone's focused on the split, but what do you get for that split? Because, you know, 100% of zero is zero.
Yep.
So that's great if you can get 100% commission or 90% commission, but what are you getting in return? So when you're, I don't think, obviously split is important, how much you're going to get paid. As a new agent, don't expect to get paid 90%. It's, you know, would you go into your first job out of college and expect to make the same salary as someone who's been doing it for 10 years? I don't think so.
Some people do.
Yeah, right. So I feel the same way. I had interviewed at some brokerages and here's the list of what we charge monthly. And it's like, well, what if I don't make any money this month? I have to pay you, you know, I have to pay you to like print on your printer, you know, and, you know, some, I think that some of these places try to get you with their profit sharing and, you know, I mean, some of it's kind of pyramid schemey, but it's, so we think you have to look at how much money are you going to get paid off the bat? What kind of mentorship or training are they going to provide? What kind of resources are going to be available to you, you know, online or whatever their, you know, back end system is? Are there classes and training and trainings and events that you can go to? And what are you going to have to actually do yourself? Like, I don't have to go put my signs in the ground. You know, I call my boss and I tell him to take care of it. And he takes care of it. I don't know where these signs go, where they come from, or he just does it for me.
That's awesome.
Yeah. So I think it's little things like that too, like that you don't think about, you know, who's going to, so when I get a listing, you know, where do I have to turn my paperwork and, you know, who's going to put up my signs, who's going to print out my marketing material, who's going to pay to print out my marketing material? Do I have to order it? You know, I don't have to.
Now the answer is Gerard.
Yeah.
Just make him do all the office stuff.
Exactly. If you don't have a Gerard, then find a brokerage like mine.
You mentioned one of the things was like the either the online or the infrastructure that they have. And the one big thing for me as a new agent, I was very focused on lead generation because that's the one thing I don't have. I don't have anybody, and I didn't want to go through the 100 people of my sphere and call and text them. They know that I'm in real estate. So like they got it. They know I'm here. I want to go after people that maybe don't know me. And some of the offices don't really have a big lead generation. It's just calling. Like you just have to open up a phone book and call.
Right. And that's how they train you.
Yeah. And I know that there's software out there and, That was a big thing for me. So like some of the things that you just spoke on, if you're getting into being an agent, keep an eye out for those things because they are very important and they swing so differently from broker to broker.
Right.
I know real estate all seems the same, but every office runs differently. It's crazy how different each of them can be. Even like big box to big box, they work so differently. And like you said, yours is franchised, so even more differently than that.
Right. I think that's what's important is going, you know, decide what kind of environment you're looking for. If you're looking for something that's more corporate and where you're going to be just a number and, you know, but if you, for me, what was important was flexibility and opportunity. Those are the most important. And I was able to get that with where I am, which is why I've been there for 12 years.
Yep. And now the flexibility has turned into working 24/7.
Yeah, exactly.
So they did it right and you're doing it right. So congratulations on that.
Thanks.
With your obviously limited time now, do you and your husband set up annual goals or is that done within your brokerage? Like, cause you said you work on your own independent team. So do you get to set your own goals and you and your husband are like on the road every year to like hit those or
Yeah, we do. So we sit, we'll kind of go over them together. And then my boss usually will take us out to dinner and kind of go over and try to brainstorm ways that he can help us get there, or things that we can do differently to save more money or make more money. And so it's nice to have that like kind of casual, not really kind of like coaching, I guess it would be. Yeah. Right.
It's important, especially starting, having somebody to lean on, because you're on an island. There's nothing. You don't go to the water cooler and ask somebody for help because you're stuck on a problem. Like, it's figured out.
Yeah. And so I think what's helped me is really like writing it all down. I'm not like a big, you know, manifestation type of person, but I think seeing it helped you. And also looking at it on a smaller scale is you go, okay, if I want to do 20 million this year, well, how much is that a month? And how much is that a week? And looking at it in smaller numbers, I think helps it feel more achievable. Yeah. So that's,
it's like working that, backwards.
Yeah. When you look at it, it's really, you know, once you know the steps that you need to take to get there in a weekly or on a monthly scale, it's much more, it's much less scary to look at it that way. And it feels like, oh, I've done this before, which is nice.
Yeah. And I think, I think it was Go for No. Have you ever read that book?
No.
It's a good book for anybody in sales, even if you're not in real estate, just sales. But they do talk about like working backwards and instead of going out and trying to get the amount of yeses you need in a week, go out and try and get no's. And they kind of work on, all right, if you want to make, like you said, 20 million in the year, what's the average home sale price? Then what's your commission out of that? And then how many clients would you need to hit that? And then how many phone calls would you need to make to have successful conversion to clients? So if you're going on like a, let's go on the high side of 10% conversion rate. Mm-hmm. That's on the high side. How many phone calls do you need to get those 10 clients to get those deals done to make that money? And for people starting out, like that's an easy way. You can go on Google and find your average home sale price and put your market here, and then it'll give you your average home price. And now you just work that way to find out, all right, I'm starting, I need to make 100 phone calls a month to get two clients to get X amount of sales in a month. And in some ways it makes it more palatable to like, okay, all I have to do is that, but also it's daunting because you're like, all right, I'm making 100 phone calls and 98 people are going to say no. But when you go in and you look for 98 no's, then
you're expecting the no's.
And it doesn't hurt as bad because you're going to get rejections. And just like we are saying, don't work with every client. As a buyer or seller, don't work with every agent. Don't work with the first agent that shows up.
Yeah. Because and don't work with the agent who's telling you what you want to hear. I actually recently lost a listing. It was a referral. It was a small condo. And I mean, the comps are putting it at like in the low 300s, you know, low to mid 300s. And they listed it with someone else who put it on the market for like 380, I think, or 389. And it's been on the market for 3 weeks. And so, I mean, it's,
that's when you don't feel bad and you're like, well,
I tried. You know, I mean, I told you so, but you know, it's going to be on the market for 2 months because you're going to have to price drop it now, probably two or three times before you get to market value. But now, like I said before, right, you're going to chase the market down. And so maybe in 3 months it's worth 300. You know, I mean, maybe it goes back up. Who knows?
And to break it down of like, okay, you want to sell it for 380. Mm-hmm. The market's telling me three. If this sits on the market for 2 months, how much are you paying? Because now you just lowered your sale price and your proceeds because you just held it for two more months longer than you wanted to. So like you got to factor in, and let's say you're buying another house and now you have two mortgages. Like, at some point you just got to like, I know the emotions tied to it. And I know you really like love the things inside and love the area, but like sometimes you just got to let it go and move on and you won't get top dollar for everything. Don't win every, what is it? Don't win every battle, but win the war.
Yeah. Like,
just give and take in some places. And some people don't want to to give. And it's like, I can't help you then.
No, I know. I always, and that's the way I always approach, you know, price reductions and negotiations with sellers, right? It's okay. So if you don't agree to whatever concession the buyer wants after the home inspection, right? It's like, is it really worth you having to pay? You know, you go back on the market, it takes another week to get an offer, you go through home inspection again, now you're back at the negotiation table, now you've paid an extra month of your mortgage, you know, an extra month on your taxes, an extra month of HOA fees if it's a condo. And so it's, at what point are those numbers a wash?
Yeah. I don't know how many times I've said, I know what they're asking for is unreasonable.
Yeah.
But what I'm asking you, is it worth it? Like, I know that they're asking for $500 because an outlet's broken or something like that.
Mm-hmm.
Like, is it worth fighting them? Either like go fix it and tell them you fixed it, or just right. say like, all right, go fix it and take the 500 right. and just move on. Because right. are you willing to lose the deal over that much?
Exactly.
Because this is the proceeds, you're sitting here and we're arguing about this.
Right.
So mm-hmm. like, which way are we going to go?
Yeah.
We didn't even get into, we're hitting our hour here and yeah. we try to keep it down.
We can come back again. It's okay.
We're going to have you, we're going to have the whole team here next time.
Yeah, definitely.
Because you said that your husband's taking on to the marketing side.
Yeah, he started like his own YouTube kind of passion project. And now he's like really into all of, you know, starting the podcast and YouTube and editing. And so, that's kind of like the next direction we're going, is trying to show up more
awesome.
And provide as much education and content as we can, because it's such a diverse market.
Yeah, I think that would be cool, because the one thing that we didn't get into that I was trying to get to was like the landscape of Boston and how mm-hmm. it's all broken down and kind of where you guys operate from. But I think it'd be cool to start yeah. there next show, and then we can kind of bring in how he, obviously you guys are targeting a market. How do you guys deliver your message to that market?
Yeah.
To get your clients? I think that'd be a super cool, topic that we have not done on the show yet.
Yeah, that would be
an actual in-depth show on that one. So next time we'll get both of you guys on.
Yeah.
We'll talk a little bit about like the Boston actual physical area. And then we'll kind of tie him in if that works for you.
Yeah, that sounds great.
That'd be cool. And then we can recap your 2022, because I think.
Yeah, I'll be a recurring guest. That would be great.
Yeah.
That'd be awesome. It gives me a reason to go travel places.
Good. Yeah, that would be awesome. We'll bring you out. If you get out here at all before the fall, we can bring out some new construction projects that we have going on.
I do want to see the new construction and see, because I'm guessing that they're trying to keep the historic feel to it all.
In some cases, you would be pleasantly surprised at how modern
really?
Buildings can be. Yeah,
that'd be cool. And then I have to go see, and I'm trying to hold down the gag reflex.
I know
the best architecture in Fenway Park, and I'm going to end the show there, and we're not going to talk about it. I don't like Boston, but that I got to go see the stadium.
You have to.
Or I guess I had to do it, so you have to do it too.
I have to. Not a knock on Baltimore, because that's number two. So
I'm a Baltimore fan, so.
We've got two great parks to go see.
Yeah.
But I appreciate the time. Thank you so much. Keep it rolling. Hopefully you and your husband have a great end of your 2022. And then we'll catch up in 23. I think that'd
sounds
be fun.
Good. Yeah, that sounds
awesome.
Great.
Thank you so much for coming on today.
Yeah, thank you guys for having me.
Have a great weekend.
You too. Bye.
Bye.